This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. Fire up the DeLorean. We're going back in time. The History of WWE.com proudly presents the History of Wrestling podcast right here on Place to Be Nation.
Ladies and gentlemen, small creatures, big and small, of all kinds, to the History of Wrestling podcast. Brad Stutz alongside Graham Cawthon of the History of WWE and D-Mac, Dan McGinn of the Place to Be Nation, coming at you once again, talking about hardcore wrestling, but specifically kind of the evolution of hardcore wrestling and how what was a bit of an underground and sort of small-time phenomenon was kind of co-opted into the big leagues. You might want to say it's how extreme became mainstream. And Graham, this is the 10th or 11th year that WWE has done some version of an Extreme Rules pay-per-view under various names. We just had the 2015 incarnation here very recently, and that's what kind of inspired this discussion, because you know, years ago it was a thing to read about, you know, the crazy stunts that were going on in ECW or whatever, and now there's still some of that on the fringe, but for the most part, all these ideas of breaking tables or whatever have been co-opted and sort of streamlined into the WWE machine. What's your initial thoughts on that? Where is it? It's certainly safer in a lot of aspects, but is it as exciting as it was, you know, 10, 12 years ago to hear about these crazy things that happen?
Well, it's a very different atmosphere. First of all, how are you?
I'm wonderful.
Dan, how are you?
Oh, hanging in, you know, definitely nice. All the snow's melted up here and, you know, Basil and I got a nice walk in and, you know, feeling good to hear you from you guys again. I never thought we'd get back to this point, but we've made it. We've made it.
Gotta have faith, Dan.
Like George Michael.
Mm-hmm.
Gotta have a jukebox and tight jeans.
Mm-hmm.
I have both.
That didn't actually need to be responded. Anyway, we got a response. That works. Yeah, it's, I mean, Extreme Rules this past Sunday, there's been a lot going on lately. We had the pay-per-view, we had the King of the Ring this week. We have a ton of new WWE Network content that I have fallen into and have loved a lot. Have you guys seen the Renee Young show that they launched?
I watch everything with Renee Young, even when she's just in the shower at her own home. I watch all Renee Young
That's
all the
felony.
Time. Hey, we don't use words like that around here.
We don't have our own legal team, so I got to look out for us.
I have not watched it. I probably will. I have a whole backlog of stuff from the WWE Network. I was trying to catch up on NXT, and then there was all the hoopla about some of the different his bells are ringing, like all the different things going on. You know, Jerry Springer's in the house now. I guess that's relevant. And you have the King of the Ring thing yesterday, which was very popular. A lot of guys on the Place to Be chat pages were talking about that. A really nice throwback. You got the Merryweather Giant documentary type deal that they're doing towards the end of the week, but. Yeah, a lot of, and this is what we've been kind of, I guess, hoping for some of the people that do the podcasts about fixing the network and how things could be better. It can only get better if you provide a lot more new, exclusive, interesting content. And even if you're an old school guy who wants to see Hulk Hogan rock and wrestling again, me, for instance, you know, it's something new. It's not like you don't feel like you're looking at the same stuff every single day when you put it on your network.
Right. It's kind of, and we will get back to the hardcore thing. I just want to take this on a little tangent right here. Is it really feels like it's becoming a lifestyle content provider. So like I was watching the Corey Graves, his own show, and he goes and visits Marvel headquarters in New York City. You've got Renee Young, who has breakfast with Seth Rollins in Colorado Springs. You've got the Jerry Springer stuff. You've got the Hogan cartoon. It's something in which they are providing content for as many different demographics as they can, which is brilliant. It's almost like, why do I need a Travel Channel? Why do I need a History Channel? Why do I need all those things when WWE can produce their own spin on that content?
Oh, yeah. They're taking over everything. NXT's taking over the Indies. This Renee Young thing. Eventually, it's going to be 2 hours, and they're going to take over the shoot interview. They're taking over everything.
But
Man
with their
versus
own,
food is going to be
their,
everything.
Their own brand. I mean, what they've considered themselves for years, for decades now, is an entertainment brand, a lifestyle entertainment lifestyle brand. And now they are showcasing that visually, and I'm loving it. But yeah, I just wanted to hit on that. I think it's just been a busy week, and the whole point that kind of brought us together is the Extreme Rules. But there's been so much happening since then. I didn't want to ignore it. But yeah, going back to the pay-per-view or the concept of the pay-per-view, like it's interesting if you look back because even before Extreme Rules, like what was that the answer to? Before that, it was One Night Stand. Before that, it was a combination of WCW Uncensored and the original ECW. And it's so interesting to think that Uncensored, so many of us kind of think back on it as being this this cartoon interpretation of ECW, of hardcore. But that was like the first – that was like a retaliation to ECW. ECW is getting all this buzz that WCW felt that, oh, we need to capitalize on this. And it was not quite the same thing. But yeah, I think right now we're very much in a safe zone. Like we call it Extreme Rules, but I don't know if there's anything necessarily extreme about it.
Yeah, I think it's definitely, I think you hit on something in the sense of it's such a different era. It's such a different time. You know, pretty much everything you watch, you guys were touching on, you know, all the new content that's come up on the network in the past couple of weeks. And one thing in particular was those 98 Raws. And if you watch those and compare, you know, going on now, it's night and day, but it's also night and day as far as where kind of society is, you know. It's not just WWE in the sense that a lot of the stuff that they were doing back then wouldn't fly now, even outside of their own, you know, content restrictions. You know, standards and practices are different now, and people's tolerance for, you know, racial humor or sexual humor. It's become a much more PC society, a much more sort of sensitive society. And I think the modern incarnation of the Extreme Rules pay-per-view exemplifies that in the sense that, you know, a couple of things that look familiar, like the kendo sticks or maybe a big table bump, and those things, you know, hurt just as much as they ever did. But it's so much more – controlled and contained chaos than the shows that it's kind of playing off of and based on.
Now, I got a few questions for you guys. You know, obviously before we had these annual catered extreme pay-per-views, there was ECW. But before ECW, there was Terry Funk, there was Abdullah the Butcher, there was the original Sheik. Now, what do you think of when you hear the term hardcore wrestling? And as a follow-up question to that, are you a fan of that genre?
I guess for me personally, I certainly was as a teenager, growing up and being in high school and even a little bit into college. I was so into, from about the time I was, let's say, you know, 13 through about 21, so into all of that stuff. And every ECW arena show and every ECW TV and,
I know I got most of your collection.
Yeah. It's absolutely that was what I lived for. That was what kind of spoke to me as a fan. But yeah, I would say even earlier than that, you know, I remember being wowed when, Randy Savage pile drove Rick Morton on the announce table in Memphis. And that's early 80s. Mm-hmm. And I saw it years later on a tape and thought it was crazy. I remember Cactus Jack against Mil Máscaras from the Clash of Champions, where Cactus takes the crazy flat back bump off the apron and like clanks his head against the floor. And I remember running that back and playing it as of times. To some extent, there was always a little – there was always that spark in me that was like, ooh, the sense of something unconventional, the sense of legitimate danger always kind of spoke to me. Bruiser Brody was one of my first favorite wrestlers because he had that sense of legitimate danger. And so when ECW began to brand themselves and market themselves after that, it spoke to me as a viewer in a big way.
So, Dan, what about you?
I was not a huge – it wasn't anything that was really introduced to me at a young age, although I will say this. I think Abdullah the Butcher might have been the closest thing that I came to first experiencing hardcore, if you will, if that's how you want to define it. I had one of those great pictorial-like books, you know, that's like the size of a coffee table, and you'd flip it, and you'd have like a mini wrestler bio, and you'd have some different, you know, wrestler pictures, and they were, some of them were pretty candid, and some of them were from matches, and you would flip, and you'd see your guys, you'd see Hogan, you'd see Warrior, and you'd see some of the big names from WWF, which was what I was raised on in the late 80s, but then you would like get towards like the middle to the end of the book, and you would get to see some of these guys like Abdullah the Butcher, and Carlos Colon, and their like faces were covered in blood. Now, of course, you know, growing up in the blue bar steel cage era, cartoony, you know, larger than life character driven golden era of WWF, I was like, where is this? How do I get access to that? Because this is obviously not on the shows that I'm watching. And then you would find like some like old world class thing with like Abdullah the Butcher taking on somebody like the Missing Link or you know, the Great Kabuki, and you all of a sudden your world just got opened up to a whole new can of worms right then and there. It was watching Abdullah over the years throughout the, you know, during the 80s and stuff, and seeing how crazy violent pro wrestling could be, it's kind of like, I think we were talking before we even started, Graham, when you watch something like the NWA or you watch something like World Class or something where those guys were performing, like the early Starcades, you would look at the ring and you would see blood all over the place. If you watch the same event, a WWE event around the same time period, you wouldn't see anything like that. And it's almost like heavy metal rock versus pop rock top 40. You know, it's like, it, even though they're kind of under the same umbrella, it's a completely different product. And that's kind of how, the differences that we're seeing between true hardcore and kind of like this kind of campy, you know, mass produced hardcore extreme that we get nowadays.
That's a really great analogy, I think. I completely agree. And, you know, by contrast, the WWF shows, you know, I watched them and I consumed that content. I was always renting Coliseum videos and things of that nature, but it wasn't as fulfilling. They were kind of boring by comparison to me, compared to, you know, a great you know, Crockett angle where, you know, the Russians have clotheslined Magnum TA in front of his mother and things of that nature. Like, I watched I liked the kind of cartoony element in the episodic television. I love Saturday Night's Main Event. I love shit like George the Animal Steal at the Zoo, and I love stuff like that. But if it's just straight wrestling, I found a lot of the WWE shows at the time boring by comparison. It was never really my favorite wrestling product. Gosh, up until relatively recently in my life, the last, you know, pretty much after everyone else had gone out of business. I always consumed the WWE content, but I was always more into, you know, ECW or Smoky Mountain or Memphis or NWA or whatever, because it seemed like the in-ring product was just more exciting. The angles were more exciting. I wasn't anti-WWF and I wasn't anti the WWF circus, but yeah, in-ring, it was never my cup of tea. What about you, Graham? You kind of grew up on WWE, but you branched out and started learning about other stuff. What was your thought on that now, and what's your thought on that then?
Well, I was thinking before we came on about what probably was my first introduction to hardcore, because I became a fan during the early 90s, and you know, that was a time in which you really didn't see much because the industry was just trying to play it safe. They had gone through so much bad publicity. They were trying to get away from the sex scandals. They were trying to get away from the steroid scandals. They were trying to draw as little negative criticism and attention as possible. And I really think my first glimpse into wrestling that appeared dangerous was probably Spin the Wheel, Make the Deal. I remember I was not watching WCW on a regular basis, but I stumbled across the pay-per-view channel, and back then they would just show, you know, on constant repeats whatever's coming up, and they had the Sting Jake Roberts mini movie, and they kept showing that on a loop. And yeah, I'm saying the mini movie, not so much the match, but mm-hmm. just what they were hyping was, you know, barbed wire, and I think maybe Scaffold was on there, and Texas Death Match, and you know, all these things, and I'm thinking, what in the world? Because I'm watching WWF at the time, and that was very much, you know, Bret Hart, Ric Flair, Randy Savage, and no one was, you know, actively trying to go in the ring and attack someone with barbed wire. I mean, the closest you got was Papa Shango making you throw up. Mm-hmm. And you know, and I remember one of the options was Spinner's Choice. And they always kind of alluded that, you know, whatever it was, like Jake's going to come out with a knife and just like cut off Sting's head. Like, it was just like the worst thing in the world. And I remember I was watching it like late on a Friday, late on a Saturday, something like that. And my parents are getting ready to go to bed. My dad walks in the living room and he sees I'm watching it. He doesn't know what it is, but the simple vibe that it was putting off. I remember he told me, as I'm like 10 years old, he said, I don't think you need to be watching that.
Wow.
And yeah, I mean, just from watching the mini movie, just the vibe of it, the violence that it promised. And obviously the match itself was nothing to write home about, but I think the closest comparison, or like the next big impactful thing of that nature, probably would have been Cactus and Vader the next year, which I love to this day.
Yeah, I absolutely love that match. It's funny how you word that. You asked a little while ago what my introduction, so to speak, to hardcore would have been, and it probably would have been. I was real young. I was like 4 or 5, and the Great American Bash 1987 VHS tape.
War Games.
Well, it's got War Games, but they're stuck in the middle is Dusty Rhodes and Tully Blanchard barbed wire ladder match.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
And I'm watching this at like 5 years old, and you know, there's some blood, but it's that match is two professionals working a gimmick match, you know? It's not grotesque, it's not unsafe. So in a weird way, watching that match over and over again, when I had that on VHS from, you know, from virtually the day it came out, watching that and even the War Games, it almost kind of desensitized me to violence, to hearing about like a barbed wire match or whatever, because, you know, I had seen one, and yeah, it was, but they only used the wire, you know, here and there. It wasn't grotesque. It wasn't like, let's say, the Sabu Terry Funk barbed wire match that came a decade later,
right,
where, you know, you're like, oh my God, like somebody's going to die in this fucking match. The Dusty Tully match wasn't like that. It was, you know, they used the barbed wire a couple of times in the match, but it wasn't gruesome. It wasn't grotesque. And so in a way, strangely enough, it kind of desensitized me to it a little bit, because I had seen that, you know, you could have a barbed wire match and nobody gets maimed and nobody looks like they've walked through a razor blade factory and are bleeding from head to toe. And in a way, that made some of the stuff that went on later even more jarring, because I was, you know, 12 years old talking to the TV like I'm Jim Cornette, like, guys, let's tone this down. Like, slow, you know, it kind of put me in that mindset early on, and I'm watching Tommy Dreamer get thrown off the roof and fall through 8 tables, and you know, Brian Lee chokeslam Tommy Dreamer basically off the top of the ECW arena like 4 ECW arena shows in a row or something. And it's like, goddamn, guys, like, calm down. And I loved the ECW style. I loved the way the characters were presented, but I wasn't a fan like some were who came for the violence. Like, New Jack was fine and everybody got into his shtick, but I wasn't someone that came to an ECW show to see New Jack fuck someone up and hit them with a VCR. Like, that was
hilarious.
Fine.
I'm sorry, it's hilarious that you were watching Bash 87 at such a young age. It's almost like the equivalent. I remember I was like 9 or 10 years old, and my next door neighbor was a couple years older than me, but he got to watch pretty much whatever rated R movie he wanted. That was you.
Yeah, without question.
That's the equivalent. I mean, that was you. You got to watch Terminator and Aliens and all that fun stuff.
I got to watch way worse stuff than that. I was watching like Night Eyes when I was 7 years old on Cinemax at like 2 in the morning.
Poison Ivy.
Yeah. Oh,
listen,
yeah.
Listen,
oh,
it took you long enough.
Brother,
we're talking about hardcore.
I still got
it took
all
you long
enough
to mention
on DVD
that.
Now. Like, we could watch them today. Like, it's good.
Can we do a live watch of Poison Ivy, particularly the one with Alyssa Milano in it? I love that one.
Alyssa Milano. yeah, and I don't want to make any kind of I don't want anyone out there to make any kind of, you know, judgment about my parents or anything like that. I truth be told, I just could never sleep. So everybody else would be asleep, and I would sneak and do these things.
Well, a couple things to you know, to pick up on your points is that War Games was actually one of those things that kind of sort of introduced me. I know a lot of people say, well, there's lots of things a lot worse than War Games. But I once saw Sid Vicious basically kill Brian Pillman. Like,
oh, yeah.
Brian Pillman might have died years later, but I can't imagine. I think he might have lived a lot longer, perhaps, if he didn't get into that match with Sid Vicious getting powerbombed. And, you know, I mean, he looked dead. And I remember watching that and thinking, I don't know if I'm going to see him next week on television. Like, I was, like, really, I mean, I was young, but I just, like, was sitting there thinking to myself, Man, oh man, this isn't the wrestling I grew up. This isn't like, you know, clowns and happy and fun and Hulk Hogan wearing yellow. Like, this is crazy, you know? And then about the never sleeping thing, I don't know when. I can't find out exactly. It was maybe around 97-ish. Don't quote me on the year. But I seem to recall not being able to sleep on a Sunday or a Saturday night. And flipping the channels, and of course, as a teenager, you know, you flip through the channels, you never know what you're going to find. And I never thought that I would find anything on the Spanish channel worth watching, unless it was someone who was speaking in a language I didn't understand wearing a tight-fitting outfit or cleavage or anything like that. But when I turned on the Spanish channel up here in Massachusetts, that was the channel that ECW broadcasted on. So, you know, I got to see all kinds of stuff. I can't remember what the matches were to save my life. I do know that I seem to have a vague recollection of the whole, like, Jerry Lawler and the caning the testicles and that sort of stuff. And, you know, things like that probably happen all the time. But it was like, this is incredible. I could feed my wrestling fix as an insomniac, like, you know, obviously horny teenager. Just I can get, you know, watch this. Gosh, man, I mean, it was like, again, a complete culture shock for someone who was raised on basically WWE, Golden Era, New Generation, that sort of thing, to then be able to flip something on like that was just crazy. Like, guys diving into the stands, the whole handing out of weaponry from the fans giving weapons to the other wrestlers. I mean, it was just so revolutionary. And that term gets, like, thrown out there a lot, and Heyman will talk about how it changed the game, and it really did, if you think about it.
No, well, it absolutely did.
It did, because especially during that time in the industry, everything was so safe. Mm-hmm. Everything was so watered down and meant to kind of quell whatever whatever the media was trying to get on them about. But your ECW story, I want to share mine because I had forgotten about it, but I remember in the fall of 1995, I was moving from Metro DC to Panama City, Florida, and I had never actually—I don't think I had actually ever seen ECW. I had obviously getting all the After magazines; they had covered it, you know, page to page, and they had just saturated it, and they had made it up to be this new hot underground thing that everyone was talking about, and it was fresh and it was cool and it was, you know, everything that the WWF and WCW was not. And I remember I was moving, and at that point I had a decent collection of wrestling VHS tapes. And so we're moving into the house, the movers are there, they're bringing up the boxes. And I remember the movers were wrestling fans. They said something about the tapes that I had. And we got to talking about ECW. And they said, yep, they just took it off here. It was on. It was on. But they just took it off here. And that kind of speaks to, the danger that genre falls into, the bad attention that it can get. Because they were taken off the air lots of places. I remember this would have been late 95. Satellites were big. You guys, dish services were huge. And it was a time in which you could pretty much that was the best way to get ECW television is to have a satellite service.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember going to like the newsstand or something, and they had a TV guide for whatever satellite provider it was. And I was flipping through and I went, ECW, 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 just like seeing what the schedule was. And that was pretty much the only way you could get it, because they were being taken off cable television.
Yeah. And, that whole style, that revolutionary way of presenting wrestling. And, you know, it's not necessarily about like blood or even weapons, because anybody who lived through it or watched it or enjoyed it will tell you, you know, Memphis had blood and Mid-South had some of the grittiest brawls ever, but it wasn't the basis for the promotion. It wasn't how the show branded itself, and that was what was revolutionary about ECW. Plus, you know, introducing very modern characters, very modern music, and kind of, you know, the theme of this show today is that all those ideas in various forms would go on to be co-opted by WWF and WCW at the time.
Right.
And that leads us to, you know, something like Uncensored. And Dan, I know, has spent a few days now very diligently watching the Uncensored pay-per-views from the late 90s. I have been very diligently watching the 1998 Attitude Era Raws that have just come up on the WWE Network. And here in a minute, we're going to kind of talk about how that revolutionary style of presenting wrestling would end up making its way to WCW and WWF, and how it, you know, like I said, was basically co-opted by the big two. Dan, give us your thoughts on these uncensored pay-per-views. For anyone that's never seen them, the concept was basically like WCW doing an ECW style show. And Dan, you've sat through quite a lot of them in the past few days.
Yeah, I tried to kind of remember what I was doing, or you know, some of the different things, because as I was saying before, I was more of a WWF, WWE guy prior to getting into just of just about everything else. But in trying to go back to Uncensored, you know, a lot of the stuff that WCW does always kind of gets shoved aside and just chalked up to, well, they were a joke anyway, they were going to mess things up. So I really wanted to see for myself how the other half lived in doing this project of trying to watch all the Uncensoreds. And it's wild how early on, I think they were just trying to be edgy. They were just trying to sit there and try to throw as many type of gimmicks at you and kind of disguise it as, well, these are not sanctioned. These are not what you would normally see. So that's why you want to go out and get this pay-per-view. And so when you look at the card in 95, which I'll go in through more in depth later on when we do our picks of the week, you just every single match seemed to have some sort of hook, whether it was good, bad, crazy. It was just something to kind of make you think, well, this is not just going to be like any other show you have ever seen before. And when you kind of look at some of the matches, you realize at the for the time period, 95, where WWF was bringing out garbage men and hockey players and all kinds of just jobber, you know, everybody, every single gimmick was an occupation. You take a look at what WCW was doing, and though it some of it landed flat, it was kind of like, well, here's something different. Here's a real alternative. But then as you got later on in its run, you started to see some of these concepts that we now see all the time. I mean, we call them triple threats, but back then they called them triangle matches. You had the Chicago Street Fight the other day, but we saw Chicago Street Fights back in 98, back as far back as 96, or back far into, you know, when we're the Road Wars. You saw that even before that during the early Starcade. So it's just wild that in the early part of like 95, 96, it was all gimmick Palooza, and then you started to see that they were really starting to hit their stride as far as what the gimmick was later on, trying to kind of compete with ECW. You got to start to see that influence with garbage cans and weaponry and that sort of thing involved in some of the matches. So, but it's funny, guys. It just goes to show how much I like you all, because I watched a lot of crappy wrestling over the last 72 hours just to make this somewhat presentable for you on this podcast.
Well, quick question. What did you like?
You know,
King of the Road match! King of the Road match!
I'm not going to say King of the Road match. Not at all. I mean,
match ever.
The Chicago Street Fight, they were Sting and Booker T teamed up to face the Road Warriors. That was in 96. was surprising. And as far as I didn't necessarily think that I would enjoy it, and because I wanted to hate like every match on these cards, and you know that one certainly had some merit to it. Though the main event for that particular one, you had like that crazy triple tiered cage match.
So all Tower of Doom.
Yeah, all that goodwill that I got from seeing that Chicago Street fight was kind of wiped away rather quickly. I will say that. You also got to see
King of the Road match.
Yeah, King of the Road. No. You didn't see that. Don't see that, guy. Seriously.
King of the Road match.
The big brouhaha 97 where you had Team NWO, Team Piper, and Team WCW duking it out in that kind of combination. It was almost like a Royal Rumble, and it was almost like a Survivor Series, and the last man standing would end up winning for their team and that sort of thing.
I don't hate that. Yeah. I don't hate that to this day. I think that was interesting.
Kind of a unique concept, and it kind of, in a way, Chris Benoit kind of, you know, Chris Benoit is always kind of buried in WCW, of course.
Stop.
But then he looks great in matches buried like this. Come on.
You said it.
I'm saying, was he not?
Oh, he was definitely buried.
He still is.
Why do I do
King
this
of the Road
for?
Match.
Why do I do this for?
I fucking love the King of the Road match. I don't care. That match, I love Dustin Rhodes anyway. I love the street fight he has with Piper in 96. Dustin Rhodes is so much fun, and like they kind of beat the dog shit out of each other in that goofy fucking match. They really do, and
yeah, they got fired.
They absolutely did. Talk about
uncensored. It's hilarious to think about it. They got fired for a pre-taped, pre-edited match.
Yeah. The urban legend has always been that they got color without permission. Talk about uncensored. My last memory of uncensored is always going to be the climax of that NWO Team Piper Team WCW match, which is the moment of Sting declaring himself against the NWO. One of the coolest moments in WCW ever. And you talk about the Chicago Street fight, you know, Cactus Jack and Max Payne fight the Nasty Boys.
Yes.
In a Chicago Street fight at Spring Stampede 94, that's as stiff, as dangerous, as anything as what the ECW guys were doing. And then maybe like 10 or 12 days later, if that, Cactus makes his debut at the ECW arena and fights Sabu. So, it's interesting to think about how, you know, a guy that really was the pilot in that revolution, was one of the driving forces, WCW had him and could have, you know, maybe if management had looked at things differently, or if standards and practices had looked at things differently, or if somebody had the foresight, WCW is something that doesn't get talked about a lot. They really could have been on the cutting edge of what became Attitude if someone had, you know, the foresight to look at a Cactus Jack, or even for that matter, a Brian Pillman, or fuck, even a Steve Austin. It could have gone differently if management had looked at these guys differently, because the guys that the Attitude Era is built around, other than, you know, guys that WWE found and developed, most of the guys that the Attitude Era is built around, other than Taker, are guys that were in WCW at some point and came over. Cactus Jack, Goldust, Ron Simmons, even somebody like Mark Marrow. So it's interesting to think about, you know, that 94, 95-ish WCW, they had a lot of pieces in play that became big stars.
Yeah, actually, in doing the research for this, Stunning Steve Austin actually competed on one of those pre-match, you know, main event television show matches prior to the pay-per-view of the 95 mm-hmm. Uncensored. And then, of course, you know, shortly thereafter, he's out the door because of injury and, you know, the whole – everybody knows the story about Bischoff firing him over a telegram or whatever. But the fact of the matter is, you're absolutely right. I mean, they did have a lot of the pieces in place that would eventually pave the way for the – kind of attitude era in WWF. They had the ingredients. They just didn't know how to make the cake, as it were. But a few more points about I didn't put this as our pick of the week, so spoiler alert. But the 97 Uncensored did have that Texas Tornado match with Harlem Heat and Public Enemy. Public Enemy, of course, big names in ECW. Didn't really pan out when they went off to WWF. And of course, that, you know, and there's a whole story behind that. But you kind of got a glimpse in WCW, those two teams just beating the hell out of each other with no tags, just lots of action. Sherry gets involved. We saw a strap match with Buff Bagwell and Scotty Riggs. Really violent stuff. I actually talked to Scotty Riggs over Twitter while watching this match, and Riggs was like, well, the great thing about that match is that, you know, I took that hideous bump exiting the ring still attached to the strap, and Dusty Rhodes made a comment about there's no quiver in that body, and he really kind of had told him, I was like, they really put you off to be dead at the end of that match, and he did. I mean, he looked awful after that match was over. So again, just you kind of have to go through a lot of different, you know, kind of corny, quirky things when you try to watch Uncensored, but you can find good things sprinkled in throughout the years of during the course of that gimmick pay-per-view.
Well, here's the interesting thing about that, because obviously Uncensored was WCW's answer to ECW, but they did so much better. They were so much more effective with that style when they were still under Crockett. Because you can look back at a Great American Bash or Starrcade or, you know, any number of big events during the mid-80s, and you would find First Blood, you would find Scaffold, you would find Steel Cage, you would find Chicago Street Fight, you would find all those matches that were so much more hardcore than anything Uncensored ever gave us.
Oh, yeah. You want to see an ECW-style tag match under the WCW kind of umbrella? Watch the very first Clash of Champions and watch the Fantastics against the Midnight Express literally, like, bashing each other with tables and chairs and everything else around ringside. That's an ECW-style tag match if I've ever seen one, and I've seen, you know, quite a few of them. Let's take a break. Let's hear from all the other shows that are part of the Place to Be Nation along with us. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about how the hardcore style was co-opted by WWF and WCW and who did it better. We will touch on all that and more when we come back on the History of Wrestling.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation. PlaceToBeNation.com. The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes at PlaceToBeNation.com. You can check out myself as Scott Criscolo on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, home of great interviews, our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews, and WWE Network live watches. If you need your fix of current wrestling talk, we have plenty of options for you, including the main event, featuring a roundtable discussion led by PTBN analysts and special guests, WrestleChat.net's Still Real to Us podcast with Jeff Peck, and Wrestling with Optimism, which focuses on what we should be excited about in the world of wrestling today. Also, be sure to relive wrestling's past with Graham Cawthon's excellent exclusive History of Wrestling podcast. Sports fans have plenty to dive into as well. We featured The Extra Point with Scott Criscolo and Dr. G, as well as the twice-weekly Bauer Show, The Kings of Sport, featuring live audio wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, The Sports Lounge, hosted by Cowboy and Cowboy Sr., often visited by special guests from inside the world of sports, as well as the NBA Team podcast with Adam Murray and Andrew Reich for the deep dive into the world of pro hoops. As mentioned, all of these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. PTBN's also the home to tremendous in-depth features on pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, and more. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, Scott Keats' RSPWFAQ.com blog, and Piledriver.net for their support.
Chad, do you want your wrestling podcast to be informed by historical and analytical insight and by obsessive watching of footage from any era and any promotion and for them all to be available on one feed?
Sure do, Parv.
Chad, are you ready to shill?
I am, because I know you're talking about the Pro Wrestling Only Place to Be Nation Podcast Network.
Nothing. Let's go through that again. PWOPTBN Podcast Network.
Got it. That's where you can listen to all sorts of different shows covering the history of pro wrestling in detail.
Shows like Titans of Wrestling with my boys Pete, the man of a 10,000 discs, and Kelly, the jobber lover.
I'm a jobber.
The Pro Wrestling Super Show with Stephen Graham.
Join me, Stephen Graham.
The smash hit wrestling game show Brainbuster with
Johnny Sorrow.
We have a host of top contributors like wrestling historian Chris Zellner.
Hello, everyone. This is Chris Zellner here, starting a new podcast venture.
And the Pro Wrestling Only admins, the man who knows more about 90s wrestling than maybe anybody on earth, Charles, and good old Will from Texas.
This is Will, and I'm joined today by my good buddy Charles.
Whether it's the territories, WWF, NWA, Mid-South, Texas, Portland, tag team wrestling, Japanese wrestling, lucha, old school, new school, we got it.
And of course, the feed still has the mothership itself,
with the big boys play,
on which we continue our endless journey through WCW Supercards.
PWO PTBN Podcast Network. It's pro wrestling only.
You know you want to hear it.
Welcome back to the History of Wrestling Podcast from the Place to Be Nation. We are talking hardcore wrestling, coming right off of Extreme Rules this past Sunday. Got Brad Stutz, got Dan McGinn, and wanted to ask you guys what you thought of Extreme Rules this past Sunday. I mean, this is kind of the timely, relevant reason why we're doing this show. So what'd you guys think of it? Dan, what'd you think?
We have a very popular, it didn't happen this week, but we have a very popular reaction show on the Place to Be Nation network, and those guys do a tremendous job in being able to take what they just see and making rational arguments as to why it was good, what didn't work, that sort of thing. And usually, when I used to do shows with Steve Carino, we usually had at least a couple days worth to kind of chew on it for a little bit and be able to form our opinions. But I always wanted to give credit to guys who were able to just see something and then be able to comment on it right away. And not to sound like my man Johnny Sorrow, who was on one of those shows, but I really did enjoy just about everything about this pay-per-view. Like, I mean, he gushes over a lot of different things that a lot of people don't like, but I really was thoroughly entertained watching this show, whether it be kind of like the audible they called and having Neville take on Bad News Barrett and Neville getting a win after weeks of people yelling at and yapping at me about how, well, Neville keeps having these tough luck losses and they're just burying him. And then he gets his moment on, granted, it is the YouTube portion of the show, but he wasn't even supposed to be there, and for him to actually come out looking good and winning, I thought was a tremendous thing and a good.
Hey Dan, I don't want to interrupt. I do want to pause. And for anyone that has been saying that Neville was getting buried, I want you guys to understand what that term means. Now, please, that is not what has been happening. Now, please continue your story.
But yeah, I mean it. It just got started off on the right foot with Ambrose and Harper, and even the stuff that I really didn't have high expectations on, I thought delivered in places. I nailed it. I will say it right now because I didn't have a show to talk about how I hit the predictions on the whole ending to WrestleMania. I am now going to gloat about my prediction of saying that the New Day was going to win the tag team championship. You can read all about it in my preview on placetobenation.com. I nailed that pick. It was the right call. I got further justification of it listening to Jim Ross's show when they talked about how the popular babyface babyface team of Cesaro and Kidd now chasing the belts is best for business, is good for the company. It's going to be a hot storyline. It'll make money. And I nailed that. So I'm going to just sort of pump my chest right now on the air that I hit that. And that kind of set the tone for the rest of the show for me, because I was already on cloud nine when the New Day won the tag titles. And I just thought it was a really good show top to bottom, if you ask me.
Brad, what you think?
I thought it was fine. Nothing, and this has been a recurring problem, even in to some extent, even up through like WrestleMania. This has been a recurring problem for every show. I thought it was fine. Nothing super memorable. Nothing that if you missed it, you should really go out of your way to track it down. I thought the New Day against Kidd and Cesaro was beautiful. I've watched that match like three or four times this week. I thought that was the best thing on the show. I thought Roman Reigns and Big Show did very well. Main event, I didn't really feel, you know, was something to go out of your way to see if you missed it. And to me, that's the big... That's the big problem with trying to present, you know, a pay-per-view in this era and making it feel like a major show is there's another major show tomorrow. And with the network now, there's a major show just about every night of the week. And it really waters things down. I thought it was fine, but in the event that you missed it or haven't seen it yet, other than maybe the tag title match, which I'm sure they'll rematch for 6 months, there's nothing to track down and go out of your way to find, which to me is a problem. But nothing wrong with the show, you know, itself as a whole.
Yeah, I think for me, my mindset about the monthly big shows, and it's been this way for a long time because they've had monthly big shows for a long time, is it's kind of the equivalent of the monthly Madison Square Garden show. Like, we are no longer in the era in which a pay-per-view means what it meant in 1988. Like, it's not a quarterly thing. It's not a twice-a-year kind of thing. It's a monthly thing. And kind of like the MSG show, it was a monthly thing. They built their own programs. They brought in their own stipulation matches. They had their own blow-offs. Not every month was the biggest thing in the world, because they were, you know, every month it's up and down and they're building to the next big show. And so maybe what you're paying to see this month is just like a tag team battle royal that in the grand scheme of things doesn't mean a whole lot, or, you know, a whole bunch of, you might see, several, women's matches on today's show. So I kind of think of pay-per-views now in that sense. Now, your argument that there's nothing that you need to go out of your way to miss, that's a negative. Like, I agree with that. You need to have every show mean something, even if it's following WrestleMania, even if it's always going to be overshadowed by WrestleMania. You should have that big hook to it. And the big hook to this was obviously Extreme Rules, where we can do crazy stuff that you're typically not going to see. But I think that would carry more weight if every match had a stipulation. Now, also, yeah. The downside is you are then boxed into making a stipulation in matches that don't really call for that in their program. Yeah. Like, kind of like Hell in the Cell. Oh, we got to do a Hell in the Cell match. Who can we throw in there instead of having that organically grow? So there are trade-offs there. Maybe it was a benefit to not have every match be a crazy stipulation, because it would have been detrimental to those programs that are still developing. But I think that's the negative is it wasn't really conveyed as something that was super special that you're not going to get anywhere else. To me, it was a regular show with a few stipulations and a cage match. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I agree. I think the Madison Square Garden show analogy is an interesting one, because that really is kind of what it's like now. And that really is kind of how those shows feel. Interesting that you mentioned about, like, you know, nothing really happened. And I was talking with Grant Sawyer about that the other day, too, and he made the point – we were talking about NXT, actually – and he made the point that, you know, not something doesn't happen every week on NXT. And I was like, well, something really needs to, because there will be some weeks that pretty much nothing happens. And to me, that's a big detriment. That's a big negative. I look at, you know, Mid-South TV or Memphis TV from the 80s, and, you know, there's very rare that a week goes by that nothing happens. And I think that's sort of starting to happen more and more these days. And it's definitely making, it's making shows feel more skippable and less special. And that kind of brings me back to the talking point about the 98 Raws. Man, there's so much happening.
Yeah.
So quickly. You know, there is a balance there to be found, but I think you can't say those shows weren't exciting. What do you guys think?
They were certainly exciting. I watched a few of them today, actually, and – you know, here's my thing about the Attitude Era, and specifically 98, is there is so much character development, which is great. You know, there's a lot of investment into who these people are. There's a lot of vignettes. There's a lot of talking, but the talking, like, it's not dead air talking, which I think we get a lot of now. It's not, you know, we can wrap this up in 5 minutes, so let's give it a 15-minute segment. The detriment, the downside there is the in-ring is very secondary. And now I think the in-ring gets a lot more television time, which I personally enjoy. But there's less investment in the characters. You kind of have to find that good balance there.
But yeah, it's true. You would watch some of those, Raws and, particularly during like the heat, the highest point rather of the Monday Night Wars, and it was almost as if, well, how can we keep the eyes on us for this segment? And you almost did have kind of like that must watch thing, because you did talk about it the next day at school, or you weren't really sure exactly. It wasn't predictable. Like, you could predict nowadays, oh well, this is when Dolph Ziggler's going to talk and be in a match, and then all of a sudden, here comes Sheamus, and he's going to say something, and then Dolph's going to get rolled up, and then they're going to fight out into the hallway, and then it's going to be over. Back then, it was just sort of like, oh, okay, well, all of a sudden, wow, Sable has no clothes on, oh my gosh, and then, oh, hey, look, he's driving a beer truck, and oh my gosh, there's beer in the ring. Like, you know, there was stuff going on that was just so out of the box.
Unpredictable.
You had no, if you missed it, you felt bad. You were like, wait, so he drove a beer truck into the ring and he sprayed them? There was a beer bath? Like, you didn't want to be the kid who didn't see that for themselves, or you didn't want to see the highlights on one of the weekend shows later. You want to actually be a part of that moment. And nowadays, I see what you mean. I mean, I still enjoyed this show, and I'm not nearly as offended by Extreme Rules as I say Hell in a Cell, where it's kind of shoehorned into the pay-per-view schedule. That's a different point. But yeah, you could probably get away with, oh, you know what? Oh, cool. So Ziggler had to kiss his ass after all. Okay, well, I guess I didn't have to see that. That's fine. You really didn't have that in 98 or during the height of the Monday Night War.
Yeah, I'm a big believer that stipulation should mean something, and like I said, that something should happen. You know, this should be important. Go ahead, Graham.
I was just going to say, skipping ahead with us kind of giving our thoughts about this concept show. What purpose? What role does Extreme Rules, to a larger extent, hardcore wrestling serve in today's WWE, serve in today's wrestling industry? Where does it fall?
In WWE, I don't really think it serves much of a role at all, because WWE is so sanitized and everything has been pulled back to such an extent that it's almost guys just beating themselves up for no reason now. You know, it's different when, you know, we're trying to draw money and we're trying to, you know, get this thing over, or you know, when like Matt and Jeff Hardy and Edge and Christian having that amazing ladder match in 1999, you know, those guys were made after that. And that just doesn't happen anymore, you know? John Morrison had some incredible matches. Where's he now? You know, like, you just don't. Dolph has had incredible matches, and he's just perpetually on a treadmill, never going anywhere as far as getting opportunities and chances to advance your career. Like, that stuff just doesn't happen anymore. So, plus, every 5 minutes, we're being told that it's bullshit and it's a show and it's not real. And so it's like, well, why are we even beating ourselves up? In my opinion, it serves very little purpose, if any, because these issues don't have any heat, because the characters don't have any heat. So it's just a gimmick for a show and nothing more at this point.
Yeah.
So
you mentioned it earlier, but you are really, and this is not a criticism, but you are really channeling Jim Cornette tonight.
Yeah, I think when you I talk about modern wrestling, it's kind of hard not to, because there's just so much of the foundation of things that has been abandoned. And then every now and then, in little tiny doses, they want to remind you of it. And what I mean by that is, we're going to have a steel cage match. You know, remember a steel cage match? Well, yeah, but the cage match, and this is nothing against them personally, but the cage match that Randy Orton and Seth Rollins had was nothing like, you know, Tully Blanchard against Magnum TA. It wasn't even anything like Bret Hart versus Owen Hart. But every now and then they want to, you know, say, ooh, you know, remember the Attitude Era or remember this? And it's like, yeah, I do. But reminding me of it doesn't make, you know, it doesn't make what you're doing now feel any bigger or better or more special. It just feels like you're trying to attach what you're doing now to that.
Yeah.
And I'm not a hater of the modern product. I'm really not. It probably sounds like I am today, but I just think you need to treat it as it is and not just don't bother, you know, because there's nothing. And I'm not saying guys need to be throwing themselves off the Hell in a Cell, because I don't think we do need to be doing that. But there's not going to be anything on. There's not going to be anything extreme on an Extreme Rules pay-per-view in 2015. It's going to be something hokey or something that is safe.
Yeah.
And so it's like, why bother? You know what I mean?
They might as well go back to those blue bar cages I was talking about before, because, again, you're not going to get the same effect of when you're grinding a guy's face into the cage, which I did see quite a bit during the Uncensored marathon that I was on, you know, because you're not going to be able to get blood anyway. You know, you're going to have a Russian chain match, but basically guys are barely breaking a sweat in a Russian chain match, when really they should be, you know, this should be one of the more violent things you see during the course of the year. And you're probably not going to get that feeling after watching Cena versus Rusev 3 that we just saw this past week. So, yeah,
I agree.
Like you said, I mean, yeah,
I agree 100%.
Hardcore or extreme in name only, but it's really not anything like how we remembered, even as, you know, I mean, it's kind of like on the mainstream with WWF, you have this extreme, this concept of extreme, but it's not extreme. But then when you go to, like, lower, you go to, like, indies and that sort of thing, you're seeing guys being irresponsible just for the sake of being, like, edgy, or, well, you know what, this is what they used to do, so I'm going to go and sacrifice my own body because that's what got over back in the day. And it's like, well, you're doing this to your own detriment, because if your eventual goal is to make it to WWE, you're not going to be doing that stuff anyway. They won't let you, and you're probably going to get yourself paralyzed before you can even get there.
Yeah, and once again, I want to be crystal clear. I'm not saying that WWE or wrestling in general needs to be needlessly violent. In my opinion, it does not. But what I'm saying is, if that's the lay of the land, if that's how things are now, don't fucking bother. Don't sell me tickets to a punk rock show and then I get there and Nickelback's playing. Just be like, hey, we're doing Nickelback now, and that's the way it is. So, in my opinion, Extreme Rules the whole concept, the whole everything, it has no place in modern WWE because they're doing Nickelback now. And that's their prerogative. That's fine. But that's my opinion.
So that brings up an interesting point, because what you're saying is it's false advertising, which essentially is what the first Uncensored was. The first Uncensored sold itself as being, you know, no rules. I remember the commercial very clearly, because they even had Scott Steiner in it, because the signers were so close to re-signing in 95. Now I was thinking, holy crap, Scott Steiner's going to be on the show. I'm totally going to order it. They sold us that the Ultimate Warrior was going to be on the show, and it ended up being the Renegade. They sold us that all this crazy stuff. And I remember we got Ric Flair in drag. We got a disqualification on a show that didn't allow disqualifications. We got a mustard and ketchup fight. Mm-hmm. And so essentially, Brad, what you just said is this past Sunday we saw Uncensored.
Absolutely agree with that. I absolutely agree with that assessment. And, you know, nothing against – I love Moxley. I love Luke Harper. And I thought they had a good match. I thought it was fine. But it didn't feel like a street fight. It didn't have a build to justify a street fight. People weren't emotionally invested in it enough to justify – even calling it a street fight, but people also weren't emotionally invested in it enough for them to have gone out there and really had a true Chicago street fight either. Again, they shouldn't have gone out there and killed each other. That would have been bad too. Again, I'm saying just don't even bother. You know, like that could have just as easily been a no DQ or whatever. You know, don't. It pretty much is false advertising at this point, in my opinion.
The trouble is, too, is it seems like we see a street fight as often as we see a tag match these days. You know,
that's a great point.
It's a big feud, so let's have a street fight. It's almost Christmas time. Let's have a Miracle on 34th Street fight. You know, they even use the term street fight in their kind of overhyped, gimmicky matches. Even like the Divas, you know, sometimes they'll have their Divas street fight. And that basically, I think I remember seeing a match in like 2010, 2011, where it was like a good homekeeping match or something like that. And they were like fighting with like, you know, makeup and all kinds of, household appliances and jazz. It's like, come on. It's like, the whole concept of a street fight, you want to make it like a blood feud. You want to make it like, we can't settle this in any other way. It is completely unsanctioned. We're going to just beat the hell out of each other. And the one that can't stand up loses. Nowadays, it's like, well, hey, you know, we're just going to have a fight and it's just going to be no DQ. And, you know, we're going to hit each other with things that we're going to plant underneath the ring. And, oh, let's open up this present. And, oh, look at that. It's a, you know, whatever. And
it's just something to call a match.
It's
now
just watered down. Exactly.
I think that's a great point to bring up. And Graham, you know, you asked, does Extreme Rules or hardcore wrestling or extreme style, whatever you want to call it, you asked, does that have a place in modern WWE? That's another reason why a show like Extreme Rules really doesn't serve a purpose, because, you know, there's a cage match, four times a year maybe on Raw, maybe a little less, maybe a little more, but let's say roughly there's a cage match every quarter on Raw. That seems about right. There's little silly gimmicky street fights all the time. Like the whole purpose of this show is today talking about how that extreme style has been co-opted in, and the answer, I'm afraid, is it's just completely been watered down and nullified to the point that, as Dan kind of alluded to, it's just something to call a match now. It doesn't even really spike a buy rate or spike any more interest. It's just it's not like people get excited for them. It's just something to do now.
Do you need, in a situation like this, a lot of the criticism that I've come across for a show of this nature is, they can't bleed, so what's the point? Do you need some kind of gimmick like that to draw attention that this is a dangerous show and anything can happen?
By a gimmick like that, do you mean blood?
Yeah.
You don't necessarily need blood. You need people to care. You know,
But Ambrose, in lieu of the character development that we might have gotten 30 years ago, cutting my forehead, you might instantly care.
Some people probably would. But, you know, Sheamus got hard raid last night at the King of the Ring. I mean, you know, it happened, you know, and I don't think the Sheamus-Dolph Ziggler feud is going to be way hotter on Monday than it was on this past Sunday, you know, because he got hard weighed on the King of the Ring broadcast. You don't necessarily need that gimmick. What you need is you just need situations where people want to see this fight. Ambrose and Rollins last year I thought was great because people cared about the Shield and people cared about seeing that fight. And I was happy that they got to do the Hell in the Cell match because I felt like for the first time in maybe 5 years or so, give or take, there was a WWE match that felt like it deserved a Hell in a Cell and not just this happens to be the main event of the October pay-per-view. And you would think that would be so easy. Like, Extreme Rules is in the perfect place on the calendar because it's coming right off WrestleMania. So, like, you would think that that would be the perfect place to have these matches where people are, in theory, invested in these feuds. But it just didn't – it didn't work out this year, in my opinion. And maybe if you'd had – you know, if you had pushed up, like, a Lesnar appearance, you know – that might have helped, and I understand circumstances are different, but it's like the issue that I think people really want to see and people are really invested in, we're not going to get any movement on until Lesnar comes back, presumably in August. So this year, Extreme Rules was really handicapped, I think. Nothing against Orton. I think Orton's phenomenal, but the Orton-Rollins issue wasn't so hot. It was not hot enough to sell that pay-per-view and to sell that concept. So, you know, you would think that doing WrestleMania Returns a month later and WrestleMania Returns with a gimmick, it's a great idea on paper, but of the top WrestleMania matches, the only ones that got a return were Cena and Rusev and Orton and Rollins. So a lot of your big WrestleMania returns – they didn't come because those guys aren't here.
Mm-hmm.
So it causes the Extreme Rules show to fall short, and you get a 3 week build for something like Ambrose and Harper, which again I thought was good for what it was, but you're looking at a 3 week TV build that was mostly on SmackDown, as opposed to, you know, if they could have done a real return of a big match from Mania. Like, I feel like that's the idea behind Extreme Rules. But this particular Mania, you know, the hottest match to do a return on, you couldn't really do a return on because it's not worth using Brock for this show. So they were kind of backed into a corner by that, in my opinion.
So what is the new normal when it comes to hardcore and extreme?
There's a kendo stick and then a couple of chairs under the ring and then something funny like a Christmas present or a fucking umbrella or something like that.
Tables.
And maybe a table.
We still get we want tables chants all the time. Even if it's like a regular run-of-the-mill match. It's like, we want tables. It's like, I guess that's like the new chant you do when you're bored at a wrestling show is just call for tables. And maybe, just maybe, they'll listen and bring out one of those tables.
Pretty good talk. I think I was kind of surprised. We got a lot more out of the show than I thought we might have, but it's good stuff. Now, we do have our picks of the week, and I wanted to go over real quick. I did some digging on YouTube for the YouTube pick of the week, and there were a lot of good stuff to choose from. I think initially I had Flair Funk. I quit, which easily falls into this, but something a little bit more rare that I loved from the first year of Nitro. Funny enough, it is, as we are taping this, it aired 19 years ago tonight on Monday Nitro.
Goddamn, we're getting old.
I know. Lord Steven Regal and Finlay and the Parking Lot Brawl, which it was actually a very eventful Nitro, because it's the same episode where the Giant beat Ric Flair for his second world title, with the first one that he got a pinfall for. So that was 19 years ago tonight as we are taping this. I love that fight with Regal and Finley, and it's just so – it's as close as WCW, I think, ever got to having an organic ECW feel to it. Like, they are just literally beating the tar out of each other. They are, you know, grinding their faces into the pavement. They are ramming each other into cars. They're ramming the car doors into each other. It hurts to watch. You kind of get a mini concussion just watching it. But if you get a chance, visit placebenation.com. Find our podcast on there. We will have a link to that so you can watch the video if you haven't before. Definitely worth your time. Brad, you got the card of the week.
I do have the card of the week. And I will, once again, I'll put over that Chicago street fight from Spring Stampede 94 right up there with Regal and Finley as far as the closest WCW ever got to that ECW style feel. ECW was a big part of my life from the time that I was about 10 years old, even up to now, really. I still love watching those shows. I still think it was revolutionary. I love the characters and the music and the videos and the way that everybody was presented. So my card of the week for this week, as talked about in the history of professional wrestling, volume 2, WWF 1990 through 1999, my card of the week is Monday Night Raw from the Manhattan Center, and it's the night that ECW took over Raw. And this was a monumental, like, moment in my childhood, because I was about 13, and here were the guys, the wrestlers that I loved, and the style of wrestling that I loved, and it was being kind of embraced, I guess. It was certainly being, like, showcased by a major televised global production for the first time. So, really revolutionary. ECW had 3 matches on the show. Also a night, historically speaking, that the Road Warriors came back. But it really a fascinating show to watch and to just see how it all unfolded and how it was all presented. It is February 24, 1997, and you get a lot of that wacky WWF from the time. You know, you get like Goldust and the New Blackjacks and stuff like that. But in addition, you get Stevie Richards with the BWO against Little Guido. You get Taz against Mikey Whipwreck. You get the Road Warriors coming back against the Headbangers, and you get Tommy Dreamer against Devon Dudley. Undertaker works with Farouk. Ken Shamrock also debuts on that show. It's not on the network as of yet. I'm expecting it soon as they get back to kind of putting up those late 96 and early 97 shows. But you can go back and watch it, find it online, or read all about it in the History of Professional Wrestling, Volume 2, WWF 1990 through 1999.
And Dan, you got Network Pick of the Week?
I do. We alluded to it earlier, and it caused a lot of debate on this broadcast as well as on Twitter during the Extreme Rules. If you did follow our Twitters, there was a lot of back and forth going on about this particular show. It's Uncensored 1995. This was before Nitro even started. This was, you know, WCW's first attempt at going extreme, if you will. Everything was, and you'll see this when you hear the list and listen back to the commentary, they'll talk about how none of these matches are sanctioned or signed by WCW. This is all completely uncensored, unscripted, blah, blah, blah. And it was like gimmick fest. You'll see martial arts matches. You'll see boxer versus wrestler. You'll see falls count anywhere tornado tag matches. You'll see fights in the concession stands. You'll see, of course, the King of the Road match. Judge for yourself. I hate it. Brad loves it. And another thing that you could try, and I don't condone binge drinking, but if you do like playing drinking games, take a shot every single time they use the term Tupelo, Mississippi, and I'm guaranteeing you'll be unconscious by match number 3. So I didn't try this out, but there's also there's also a leather strap match between Hogan and Vader that, of course, was a big cluster and it's not the greatest show in the world. If you want to see a better show, watch the 97 edition of Uncensored. But you judge for yourself, and we'd love to hear comments about it. Uncensored 1995.
King of the Road match.
And Dan, do you want to? We got a little bit of social media feedback in regards to the show. Did you want to hit on that?
Yeah, you can hit us up, and we'll go through how you could find us and all that just a minute. But we did get a fan all the way from across the Atlantic in Germany. Michael Gutenberger, he commented on the Place to Be Nation Facebook page, and he has a big story about how he really, really likes hardcore wrestling. It's really, really long. I'll try to paraphrase this a little bit. He loves Mick Foley versus Edge from WrestleMania 22 and Foley versus Orton at Backlash. We didn't mention those earlier, but again, good cases in what we've been talking about. He owns Bloodsport, ECW, and TNA's Bloodiest Brawls. Do you want me to read this whole thing, man? It's pretty long.
Not necessarily.
We'd like to thank you, Michael, for listening to the podcast, for chiming in with your feedback. He is all the way from Germany, after all. The beatings that Brock Lesnar gave to Cena at last year's SummerSlam, while not necessarily, I point to Extreme Rules from 2012, the Cena versus Brock match was incredible. Everybody still kind of talks about that as far as a good use of Extreme Rules following Mania.
That match is as fucking violent as WWF is going to get in the modern era.
Right.
I'll put my name on that.
Right. And what do you remember? You remember kind of like the brawls leading up to that match, including the one where, basically, I guess Lesnar like exploded Cena's ear or something. Like he was bleeding, but it was like completely hard way. Michael, thank you for chiming in with that comment, and keep listening to us, and keep following us on placetobenation.com.
And we had another comment on the History of Wrestling Facebook page from Mark Fuentes, and he brought up some other good examples that we didn't touch on. Patterson and Slaughter in the alley match at MSG, Piper and Valentine at Starrcade in the dog collar match, and even back to the 70s with Superstar Billy Graham and Dusty Rhodes at MSG in the bull rope match. And another good point that he made is, hardcore style is good, is great once in a while to blow off a feud, but a steady diet of it makes it meaningless. And I think we would all agree with that.
I agree with that 100%. Another match, talking about those old matches, go to YouTube. It's on YouTube. Look up the UWF Battle of New Orleans. One of my favorite things ever. It's basically Eddie Gilbert, Terry Taylor, Sting, and Chris Adams just brawl all over the building. And it's wild and it's awesome. And just kind of remember that, it's 1987. It's talking like how those examples that he cited. It's there was plenty of hardcore in the 80s, like we talk about. And even, back beyond that, that's another great one to look up, is the UWF Battle of New Orleans. I love that one so much. This has been fun. It's been fun to talk about some of these old matches. We should. I'm gonna put some on later, I think.
We should.
I may do that drinking game. I'm not sure yet.
Well, we could just drink anyway. But before we go, I do want to hit on a few things that I've been up to lately, and just to share with you guys. Was fortunate this week to join Jim Cornette for his podcast. Apparently, he absolutely ran out of every conceivable guest that he could ever have on, and so I enjoyed it, and we got to talk about the Madison Square Garden book that I put out back in November. He's a huge wrestling history nerd, as we all are, and we just had a great time talking about that and talking about how MSG grew to be what it is today within the wrestling industry. And so if you guys get a chance, you can check out this week's episode. It's not up as of tonight, as of April 29, but I would imagine the next day or two it will be up. And for about the next two more weeks, I'm still looking for stories and photos and all that kind of stuff in regards to the Baltimore Arena. I am finishing up that book here pretty soon. It will include every show, every professional wrestling show that's ever been held at the Baltimore Arena, dating back to the first one in 1963. So far, I've conducted about 50 interviews. I've collected about 1,200 images. Just some fantastic, gorgeous photos of, you know, Sting after he beats Flair for the title, Jushin Liger making one of his first U.S. appearances ever, Flair versus Muda. So just some great stuff there. And some of the folks I've spoke to recently for the book, ECW's Jeff Jones, Gary Juster, he used to promote that. The arena, Nikolai Volkoff, who has lived in Baltimore since 1970, Boogie Woogie Man Jimmy Valiant, Gary Michael Capetta, Dennis Brent, who used to do the publications for WCW and WWE, and Kevin Eck, who used to be a WWE writer and also a longtime writer for the Baltimore Sun. So if you have lived in Maryland, if you enjoyed the shows that used to be held at the Baltimore Arena, you will – I mean, even if you've picked up one of the books that we put out before, this will blow them all away. So I hope you guys get a chance to look at it. We'll probably have that released by – certainly my plan is July 1st. So this will be a good one. Dan, why don't you tell everyone where they can find the shows?
Well, we are back, so you can find us now. You can find the History of Wrestling podcast in any of the following ways. You can visit placetobenation.com and click on the PTBN podcast banner on the right-hand side. In addition, just by subscribing to the Place to Be podcast feed on iTunes, you'll automatically receive the latest episodes of the History of Wrestling podcast. You can visit our friends over at Stitcher.com, subscribe there, or you could download the Place to Be Nation podcast app by hitting up placetobe.podbean.com/mobile on your iPhone or iPad. You can like Place to Be Nation and History of Wrestling on Facebook. You know I do. And, of course, if you have any questions or suggestions or feedback for our final segment, if you have comments on Uncensored 2000's use of the Lumberjacks with casts,
not
cats. Total Package, Sting, guys with broken arms beating people with casts. If you have information or any feedback on that, you can always tweet us at Stutzy, at DMACP2B, and of course at History of WWE. And be sure when you are commenting on our show, use the hashtag HOW podcast.
Guys, it's been fun. Have we learned anything?
I've learned that Uncensored features a match with Lumberjacks with casts and not cats.
No, but if WCW survived, we might have seen that match with cats. You better believe it.
Absolutely, we would have.
Well, I have nothing after that. I feel cheated that we never got the Lumberjacks with cats.
I may do one at CWF Mid-Atlantic soon.
Well, good night, everyone.
Together, Lumberjacks and cats.
Hope everyone enjoyed the show. We will be back soon. Good night.
The truck is an 18-wheeler flatbed, and the object is to blow the horn that is hooked up on top of the truck, and they are well underway here, Brain.
I don't think this is what Roger Miller had in mind when he sang King of the Road. They're moving at 55 miles an hour. You know, you get on an airplane, when it just goes up to the gate, you can't stand up or move. You're all over the place. What's going to happen in this truck? What happens if the door comes open? They'll be all over the highway.
The Blacktop Bully and the Natural Dustin Rhodes going at it immediately here. As you can see from the WCW helicopter high above, there's a camera in the truck beside. The police are following. We are out of town, way out of Tupelo here because of security reasons. And these two men are going at it as he sends Dustin Rhodes to the steel of the truck.
Well, Dustin Rhodes is probably feels at home. There's nothing but hay and manure in the back of that truck, so he should be really happy. But this match is really what the Blacktop Bully's all about.
And there you take a look at this truck. There's livestock wire around the steel cage. And this is basically a, as you take a look from high above, Dustin Rhodes and the Blacktop Bully going after it. This is what the night is all about, to settle the score.
This has got to smell like Dusty Rhodes' living room in the back of that truck.
Don't you give me a break. The Blacktop Bully sending Dustin Rhodes into the cage on the outside. There's a look at the WCW helicopter high above following this King of the Road match, the first ever. There you see high on the left. Now the Bully is trying to go and get that horn. If he can get to the horn, he will win the match.
Now where's Dustin going? He's in the back of the truck. Is he leaving?